Welcome back. I'm Gary Parr.
And I'm Christine Williams.
And you're listening to Fiber Talk, and we play with needles. Yes, we do.
Someday somebody's going to question that, I think.
Yeah, I know. Yeah.
Like, you know, it's the kind of thing that you know, your podcast, you want to have, you know, sort of swaggy type items, you know, giveaways and things like that.
There we go, coffee cups.
I'm envisioning the coffee cup, but more than that, I'm envisioning the T-shirt, right? Fiber Talk, we play with needles. Like, that's not something I don't know if I'd be comfortable wearing to work. I'm just saying.
Right. Might raise an eyebrow, yes.
Yeah, what's the graphic? What's the graphic there? Not really sure.
Oh, I'm not sure either. Yeah, what is the graphic for playing with needles?
I don't know. But I'll tell you what. I have two sisters. One of them is a package designer. So her entire job consists of making logos and packages for things like Haagen-Dazs and Dunkin' Donuts and things like that. So I'm going to present this to her, and I'm going to present it to another friend of mine whose job is to draw the cover art for comic books. And let's see what the two of them come up with.
Yeah, I would be curious. Yeah,
Yes. I don't know that either of them will be usable, but I think just finding out what they submit would be really fun.
Yep. If you get nothing but a good laugh out of it, it's worth it.
Then that's a win for me. And you know what? I'd put it on a cup anyway.
So this is our second midweek show. Just Christine and me, no guests this time, just a second midweek show just to chat and hope that people want to listen to us chat. They did last time, so, you know, we gotta take that. I do want to, right out of the gate, I want to bring up Connie Rich. Now, people who follow blogs and or read Needlepoint Now know Connie Rich as the Spinster Stitcher. And she lives in Indiana, and she's a hoot. Her writings are a treat, and she used to have a dog, Stewie, who died, and he would write blog columns every now and then. And I just follow her religiously, and I think a whole lot of other people do too. And Connie she's a candidate for a kidney transplant and is headed toward dialysis and is losing her home, and things are just not going well for Connie. And she continues to write, and she shared most of the, just about, well, I know what I know from reading her blog. She shares that, but she also shares her stitching and her thoughts, and she's just a blast. And every time she posts, I immediately stop and read what she writes. Well, anyway, she's in a tough spot right now, gonna have to leave her house and facing some serious medical issues. And so, and stupid me, I didn't write down who started it, but somebody started a caring GoFundMe type page, you know, to help Connie out. And, it started out here a week or so ago, 2 weeks ago, I guess it was, and I looked and it was about $1,500, and then I looked here just a couple days ago, and it was pushing $20,000. So I bring that up. I'm going to contribute to help her out. And Connie has already written a couple times in her blog that she was initially embarrassed, and then she just realized people care about her and want to help her, and so she is just, it's time for her to embrace that and say thank you. And she wrote a long thing about that. And I can imagine what that's like to be in that position where people are saying, hey, I want to help you out. Well, you know, it makes you uncomfortable. I'll put a link on the page for this podcast so that people can contribute. And I mean, it's been spread all over all the Facebooks and all the blogs and everything. It's not too hard to find, but I'll put a link. So anybody who doesn't know about it, if you're so inclined, help Connie out. She's already expressed extreme appreciation for what everyone has done. And you know, it's just one of those things where she's given a lot to the hobby, cross stitch, needlepoint. You know, she does them all. And, in her writings and just entertaining thing. And so if people are inclined to help out, there'll be a link, not too hard to find. And it's one of those, online setup things where you can contribute, I assume you just put in a card and, you know, your card mm-hmm. number and the money is given. So.
Yeah, that's exactly how it is. It's just like anything like PayPal, or you just put in your information, or you can do it anonymously. And then, right, you pick whatever amount you want and then it just goes right to that account.
Yeah. So that's, you know, start off on just kind of a downer note, but not really a downer in that this is an opportunity to help someone who has given an awful lot to the fiber art needlework world through her writings and sharing and just a lot of entertainment. For me, a lot of entertainment, and I'm not alone by any stretch of the imagination. And I know every issue of Needlepoint Now, the first thing I do is turn to the back page and read her column before I look at mm-hmm. anything else, because I just enjoy her writing, and she just has a way with words, and it's just good. So if people are inclined to help Connie out, there'll be a link. Do so, and I am more than confident she will appreciate it. And she's now facing, it sounded like, within the next few couple weeks or whatever, moving to an apartment. She's found an apartment, having to leave her home. And then, of course, dealing with all of the medical issues. So she's hit a rough spot, and she's already expressed she's determined to climb out of it, but never hurts to have a little help from friends. So.
No, and that's one of the great things about hobbies, I think, is that's when people are really at their best.
Yes.
Is, you know, and our other hobby was like this as well, where, you know, you develop relationships with people, and then when somebody hits a patch like this or needs something, everybody, you know, jumps in. You know, and our old hobby was reef tanks. And so when somebody needed to move, you know, they just put out an APB of, all right, guys, I need to move a tank and it's 200 gallons and, you know, I need help. And, you know, eight people that you maybe know their names or maybe not would show up at your house and it would get done. So I hope that this ends up being the same. And it seems to be, you know, it's a good community.
Yeah, it's grown. This particular effort has grown rapidly, and I have every expectation it will not stop growing. So,
You know what? While we're on the topic of things that have nothing to do with needlework, and you had mentioned the very first thing was the need of a kidney transplant. So, as long as we're plugging things that have nothing to do with it, everybody that has the willingness and the opportunity to join the bone marrow transplant group should do so. So I think the website is bethematch.com, and I'll check it. So you can go give blood anytime you want, and you just go and you sit in the trailer or wherever they're doing it and you give blood. But bone marrow, they only call upon you if you happen to be a match for somebody that's in need of marrow. And that's another one where there's way too few donors and way too many people in need. And you can donate marrow, and it's no, it's quite a bit more involved than giving blood, obviously, but your bone marrow regenerates, so you can give marrow multiple times, and it's not like an organ where you give it away and you never get it back. So all you have to do is you sign up, and they send you a little swab, and you swab your cheek so that they know whether or not you will be a match for somebody in the future. And if you ever are, they will give you a call, and then you have the option to do so or not as you choose. So the more people on the registry, the better, and the more chances are that somebody that needs a transplant will get one. So let's put that up there as well. I think it's important to do.
Yep. I didn't even know there was a thing that you could do.
Yeah.
I did not know that. I thought bone marrow was kind of a case by case. You learned of somebody who had needed bone marrow and you volunteered to see if yours matched. I didn't know that you could do
right.
that.
Right. You can do that. But it's just like any organ donation. You may or may not be a match. There is a registry that you can join, and they keep your information. I think I signed up for it, God, 11 years ago now. And they just keep your information on file. It's completely confidential, obviously, because it's medical information. So by law, it has to be. And then in the event that they are ever, you know, that somebody around the country, has, you know, an autoimmune disorder or cancer and needs to have their bone marrow wiped out and replaced, you may get a call that says, hey, you know what, you are the match for somebody and you can save their life. Will you come down and donate? And then you have the opportunity to do so. And I can't think of any, you know, greater opportunity than to be able to do that.
Yeah.
So.
Okay. Well, there'll be a link for that. We'll put a link for that. Yeah. No, I learned something. That's great. So I wanted to talk about now. This is Wednesday, and we just had Nicola Parkman's podcast on, and we'll talk about that later because that just so excited about that. But
yeah.
Something that was mentioned when we were talking with Tess and Thorne that has stuck with me, and I don't remember if it was which one, if it was Brooke or Tess, that said that for the young people and just in general, you or maybe it was you that said it, you know, you spend money to do things and you have nothing to show for your time. And then you compare that to doing needlework where you spend money and, you know, painting a canvas may be a bit expensive, but how many, you know, and how many hours of pleasure you get out of it. And when you're done, you have something to show for it. And that's really right. Stuck in my head as a way to look at a lot of things, but needlework, because that's what we're talking about here in particular, just a way to look at what do I have to show for X amount of money that I spent doing this? Well, nothing but a couple of memories. Well, that could be, you know, value in that. But if I spent that same money, and bought a canvas and some threads and got many, many hours of stitching, solitude and relaxation out of it, and when I'm done, I got something I hang on the wall, that puts a different dimension to it for me.
Yeah, it does. And I think that, you know, especially for the younger, God, I sound like I'm ancient, right? I now sound to myself like I sound to my kid. For people who have grown up in the era of, you know, smartphones and tablets and computers where you can just jump online and 4 hours go by and you don't really know how you spent it because you've watched 17 cat videos on YouTube and then read some news that you don't really care about. And it's so easy to get sucked into that, you know, just time suck where you haven't really done anything. And it's not like, you know, you can spend money on travel and that you don't have anything at the end of it necessarily, but you've done something that has enriched your life. If we can do something that is putting the cell phone down and picking up something else, I think that's important. The other thing that's interesting to think about in terms of that is that when you go to a movie or something, you go to the movie and then you leave and you've seen the movie, and that's one thing. But a canvas, or a knitted project, whatever it is, you've invested hours and hours in that, right? And this happens to me with music too, and it seems to be that it happens with projects like this as well. With the amount of hours that you've spent in that, that's been a chunk of your life. And with needlework in particular, you're sitting, you know, you may be doing other things, watching TV or listening to a podcast or music or whatever, but you're thinking about things and your life is going on. So for me, each project that I do ends up being sort of a touchstone of an era in life, right? So sometimes it's before the birth of a child, so you're working on something for something. Or sometimes it's just that, you know, that's the canvas I worked on when this was going on in my life, and I remember that time. So these become sort of anchors for memories as well. So it's not just a pretty thing on the wall. It's I remember who I was and what I was doing when I did that canvas, you know, or what was going on in my life at that time. And that can be, I think that's kind of a neat thing, isn't it? Instead of just a photograph of a memory of a period of time or a video, you have this object that represents that whole space in your life that otherwise would not necessarily be memorable because you didn't have it, something to anchor it to.
Right. Yeah. And it represents effort during that time and a lot of it, time to reflect or to think about or sort out a problem where we've talked about it. You know, the needlework occupies that side of the brain that needs to be doing something and allows the other part to actually sort things out.
And I think that came up with Tess and Thorne particularly because, you know, we talked about how that is valuable to them. You know, that was one of the things. And for me, that's certainly the case, you know.
Yeah.
I like that.
Well, that's
like
what, yeah, that's, and that's what it does. Like, I do a lot of cycling. You know, 25, 30 miles in the morning, each morning is not unusual for me. I just love to do it. But the day we're recording this, I had not ridden my bike because of rain and work for 5 days. And so mm-hmm. I went out and rode for 30 miles. And the entire time, I don't remember the ride.
Right, exactly.
I don't remember anything about the ride other than looking down to see that I was maintaining a speed and how, you know, how far out I'd been, because my mind was just sorting through a million things. But when I got back home, there was this sense of relaxation and order to my life that mm-hmm. I did not have when I left at sunrise. And needlework does that same thing. I think it does it for all of us. That same kind of thing where you give me a half an hour just to move some thread in and out of a canvas and I can figure this stuff out. I can sort this out, or I can get past mm-hmm. this thing that has just got me so wound up I want to punch someone, you know? I think that's one of the really neat benefits of this hobby.
Yeah, I think so. So one of the things I've learned as I've aged, because evidently this is the podcast where Christine is very old.
Yeah, I was going to say. Should we break out a walker? What are we doing here?
Yes, probably so. Is that when something is difficult in life, the instinct you have is to protect yourself by not thinking about it, right? So you do all kinds of things to avoid thinking about it, like going out with friends or becoming very busy doing something. And what needlework does is it does the opposite of that, is that it forces you into a state. It is like it performs a similar function to meditation in that sense, because it forces you into a place where you're sitting and you're doing a little bit of something to keep part of your brain occupied, but you have to sit with whatever it is that's going on in your life, be it, you know, a decision you have to make or an emotion that you have to process. There are things, you know, life happens and things happen that are good, and you want to kind of sit with those feelings for a while and kind of bask in them. And there are times where things happen that are bad, and you kind of have to work through this is going to hurt for a while. And the faster I let it hurt for a while, the faster I'll move on to something else. And it's so much more of a healthy way to deal with things than just pushing it to the back of your head and pretending it didn't happen. So I think it's a tremendous mental health tool for me anyway, you know, and I think I use it in the same way that people use meditation or yoga or things like that. You know,
it allows your
brain to rest on the thing that you need to do to be able to develop into a different and better person, or to work through whatever personal thing is going on that you need to deal with.
Yep. Oh, I agree. And then you got something to show for it at the end. Yep.
Yeah. So I have a 14-year-old son. So now I have to figure out how to get him involved in needlework, because 14-year-olds are full of angsty teenager things that they need to figure out. So how nice.
Angsty teenager things. New technical term. Angsty teenager things.
Yeah. Oh, believe me, if you had a teenager now, that wouldn't be that's how they are, you know.
I've had two. I know.
Yeah, I remember being a kid and, you know, doing, I was crochet at the time. I was crocheting like crazy. But, you know, to have something like this, you know, and it's for a boy, like, what do you give a boy to, you know, to do so that they can sit there and kind of work through all their feelings of, you know, 14-year-old boys have a lot of feelings that they don't want to tell you about. So, you know, like, how nice would it be to have something like that they could do? I guess video games are that for them.
I guess.
That's what it is. It's mindless shooting things.
I'm going to suggest needlepoint's a little healthier than that, but yes, probably.
You know, whatever it is, I don't know. But
whatever makes angsty teenager things go away is what
all
it is.
All I'm saying is that for 14-year-old boys, having something that would address, you know, the ability to work through feelings of growing up would be a useful thing. And I am so glad that my child does not listen to this podcast, because he would be mortified right now.
Yes, he would. Yes, he would. Mom!
I know. Yeah. Oh, my God. You would have to find a new podcast, because they'd find me murdered in a ditch somewhere.
By a 14-year-old angsty teenager, yes.
That's right. That's right. Angst drives a lot of things on this thing.
So, Nicola Parkman.
Yes.
Now, if you didn't, just this past Sunday, this is a Wednesday, so just this past Sunday, Nicola Parkman, the podcast we did with her, wow. Wow.
I know. We said afterwards we could have talked for another 4 hours.
Yep.
About all the things that we discussed, you know, so many different. And I think what I loved most about that and was that each canvas, she refers to as a she, because each canvas is so closely linked to the little girl that stitched it.
Right.
And just that sort of, way of approaching it, I think just humanizes the entire thing. Right. And it really, as you were to stitch one of those things, which of course I'm going to have to do now, again, you spend time thinking about, you know, what was it like for this little girl? And, you know, one of the things that they do very well is they give you all the history of each little girl. So, you know, that the person who stitched this was 7. So you can imagine, you know, being a 7-year-old girl stitching this canvas and it's, I mean, it's a completely different life. It's inconceivable how different it is.
Right.
So it takes on this other dimension besides just the craft of the needlework. But it's a link through time to these other people.
Yeah. It's like she said that these reproduction samplers, and that's the two things I love about the samplers other than they're just neat. Anybody's reproduction samplers is reading the history of the girl as best they figured it out.
Yeah.
And then I just love the way every chart is referred to by the girl's name. It's not,
yeah.
not the Betsy Jones chart, but it's just
no.
Betsy Jones.
And
I love
and
that.
It itself.
Right.
Right.
Right. Yeah. And it's, but then her charts, you know, I said it during the podcast and I'll say it again. I own one now and I got another one ordered. And they're, boy, they're beautiful. They're just beautiful. I mean, they really are put together very nicely. And, the stories that she told us. And I know she could have gone on, like you said, for 3 or 4 more hours telling stories about acquiring these samplers and, learning the history of them. And what a fun dimension to that whole thing. And then to stitch those and, The one chart I have, which the girl's name I can't remember right now, I mean, in a lot of ways, pretty sophisticated stitching. It's not just rows of X's. I mean, these girls were making a real effort, and these are girls, you know, us adults struggle with this stuff. And these little girls are sitting there by candlelight generating this stuff.
But you know what, though? You have to remember, and this is maybe where our experience differs. My grandmother and her parents as well were English. So, they stitched everything. My grandfather built their house here. So they came, my grandmother came to this country in, I want to say 1929. And my grandfather was born here. But my great grandparents came here in about 1929. Because my great grandfather was a silver expert, like silversmithing. And so he came here to manage a new silver museum, a museum that dealt only in British silver, and silver works. So, when they came here, they were bringing that culture with them. And so when I was born, I was given an embroidery hoop when I was old enough to hold a needle and stick it through a piece of muslin. So, you know, and that was, it was probably when I was about 3. It couldn't have been much later than that because I remember it quite vividly. So by the time you're 7, if you've been doing this night after night, you're probably pretty good. You know, you're certainly better than you'd expect, right? Because we're thinking of typical 7-year-olds here who haven't really been taught anything like that, right?
Right. Yeah.
But if you're brought up in that way where this is, you know, every evening the women sit down and this is what they do, then it's conceivable that by 7 you can be good. I think it's more the attention span. You know, we're imagining this as a lengthy attention span thing. And I wonder if these girls did, you know, sat for hours and hours at a stretch, or if they stitched for 20 minutes and then had to get up and run around, or, you know.
Yeah.
But that's the fun of it now, is that you're imagining what was the household like at the time that the stitching was happening.
Right.
Right.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. And of course, these are girls in school, chores all day long, and then to sit down at night and do this stuff. And it'd be fun to go back, you know, for threads. I mean, we walk into a store now and, you know, just this just Chuck E. Cheese, you know, ball box of threads, you know, every color, every shape, everything. And they had to, I'm sure they were limited in the threads that they could get and, and the colors they could get. And then what they did with them to make these beautiful samplers, to me, it's just impressive for little girls because many adults struggle to do anything close to that. And, you know, these little 7-year-old girls and then to figure out a verse to put on there. And the verse has some meaning to them. And then some of them that have a family tree and the initials of the family members and the ones who've died are in black. And, it's just an amazing world, these reproduction samplers. And boy, Nicholas, she was so much fun.
It was. The other thing to think about though, from a woman's perspective at that time was your training to become a wife. So while the boys were learning how to do a trade or farming or whatever it was, this was what made you, you know, your stitchery and your cookery and all of these skills were what was going to make you an eligible wife, essentially. You know, and you went and you sewed your trousseau. You sewed all of the linens and things that you would take into your new household when you got married. So it was also important for that reason. Like now you go to college, you pick a career, you do whatever. This was, you are going to have to get married. You're going to have to know how to do these things. And if you want to attract a good husband, you're going to have to, you know, have something to offer. And that was part of sort of the whole package was, you know, look, I'm a, you know, cause households were, I'm not saying that they aren't now, but, maybe the division of labor was a little bit more distinct. So the women had to sew because their family needed clothing and needed linens and needed all these things. So if you could show that you, you know, were capable of doing that well for a husband, you could attract a better husband. So it was training for life, you know, the same way that school is now.
Yeah. Let's try that old approach today and see how it goes over.
I'll tell you, stitchery has not attracted me the husband of my dreams, so I guess it's not really effective any longer.
Damn.
So I did my training. Maybe I need to do some more training.
Yeah, now see that could be speaking to you right there. Yeah.
That was the problem. I didn't pay attention when I was doing my samplers.
see? Right between the eyes. That hurt. Ouch.
Thank you very much. So yeah, it was a pleasure. It really was. And I also love the idea that it's this network of women, you know, across countries and continents working together. Again, I love the sense of connection and connectiveness that it gives to them. And it really makes me feel good to know that exists and that people like that exist.
Yeah.
And that can be a part of that.
Yep. So, yeah. So if you didn't listen to the podcast with Nicola, go listen to it. You'll enjoy it. It's fun. Yes. Even if you know everything there is to know about reproduction samplers, an absolute treat of a lady to talk to. Just terrific. Yes. So, okay. So I'm doing cross stitching again. Now, because listeners don't know, I've done 2 cross stitch things in my life. One was a sampler. The first one I did was a sampler on linen. So, you know, cross stitch, instead of using Aida cloth or Ida cloth or however you say it. I have to do a sampler on linen to start. Okay. So got that done. That's framed.
That I always choose the hardest thing.
Yeah. No, I can match you. So that's still it. And actually I'm still proud of that many, many years ago. Still framed and hangs on a wall. It came out quite nice. So, and then, I have made, my wife, my Christmas stocking is a knit stocking that my mother made. She made one for each of us kids. And I still have that Christmas stocking that she knitted. And then I made a crewel stocking from a kit from Lee Ward's for my wife. And then when our daughter Sarah was born, I did a stocking in needlepoint for her. And then when our son Kevin was born, I thought, well, I got to do a different stitch technique, you know, a different thing. So, all right, I'll do cross stitch. So I chose, I don't know the name of the pattern or the designer, but it was out of Cross Stitch and Country Crafts. And it's an incredibly involved, like three stitches of this color, two stitches of this color, very detailed stocking that I started when he was born, and I was going to have it done in a year. And it's, you know, just, I had no idea what I'd gotten myself into other than it was a beautiful stocking, and I wanted Kevin to have it. I wanted him to have, you know, this beautiful cross-stitch stocking. I finished it when he was 28. It became the standard family joke, and anytime I would stitch anything else, the black cloud that was over my head is, when is Kevin's stocking going to be done? So I, you know, and of course it just got ridiculous. And, but it was a tedious chart. And I do some.
Because it was so many stitches.
Oh, it's just so detailed.
Okay. Different colors. A lot of color changes.
Yeah. A lot of color changes on 40 count Lugana. And so finally, a couple years ago, I said, all right, that's it. I'm on a mission. I'm finishing this thing. And I got it done. And I got to tell you, I'm still very proud of it. I mean, it just came out beautifully.
Okay. And, so photos, or it didn't happen.
I can do a photo. That's not a problem. Believe me, I took photos.
That's going to be a refrain. That's going to be a refrain now. Photos or it didn't happen.
So long story to get to the real story. So we have a grandson, Cooper, who is now 2 years old. And so, all right, I should do a stocking for Cooper. All right. No reason I can't do a stocking for Cooper, but Kevin's stocking absolutely burnt me out on cross stitch. Like I don't want anything to do with any cross stitch. I'm not making more X's. And, and so then, all right, I want to do a stocking for Cooper. And all right, what am I going to do? Well, I can do a painted canvas or I can do a cross stitch because there aren't too many options beyond that. So I went to Welcome Stitchery, and I bring it all up because just so people know, if you're looking to do a stocking, what I ended up with is the Shepherd's Bush stocking. I'm doing the Harry one. Harry is the boy. There's a story about how it became Harry's stocking. But anyway, it's this vintage looking Christmas stocking, cross stitch, all done in pearl cotton. So you don't have threads to lay or anything.
Yeah.
And just a beautiful thing. And so if anybody's looking to do a stocking, I bring it all up because if anybody's looking to do a stocking and, you know, most of them look so ominous, this is one that is stitching very quickly for me. And it just really looks neat. It has a big old Santa right in the middle and a train running across the bottom.
Aww.
And really cute. And you embellish it with some buttons and things. So I just bring that up, that if you're looking for a stocking and you want to get something done that's going to look really nice but not take you 28 years, this Shepherd's Bush, there's a series of them. There's four or five of them, different designs, some that are better fit for girls and some for boys. But this Harry's one is a good one for a boy with the train and whatnot. So I just bring that up. And then, of course, now at the end of June, our daughter Sarah is going to have her second baby, a boy. And so, you know, now I've started it. So I do one, I got to do another. So I'll be returning to Shepherd's Bush to see what the other designs are, because just a real nice look. And then, so the combination of that and Nicola Parkman has me doing cross stitch again.
So I'm looking, it's shepherdsbush.net. So I pulled them up just so I can take a look at the one. It's beautiful. And you're right. They're not intimidating at all, I don't think.
No. And it's pearl cotton, so it's real easy to deal with. Mm-hmm. And of course, then I mentioned about the reproduction sampler that I have, that the little girl's name was Sarah Parr, spelled just like with an H, just like our daughter's. So that I'm doing that for Sarah. And then, of course, I have one of Nicola's, and then their newest chart is ordered. So now we have cross stitch going on, and but I'm going to jockey back and forth because I can't quit doing needlepoint, and I have those Debbie Raleigh ones that are set up and ready to go. So back and forth I'll go, but I'm on a mission to get this stocking done before Christmas. I mean, done so it can be finished before Christmas. So
I'm going to need a part-time job. because thank you and I hate you all. Because yes, now I'm completely hooked too, because I of course then I looked at this and said, those stockings look very doable.
Yep.
I could definitely do that. And yep. Christmas is such a fun thing to do crafts for, because it's, you get to see them once a year and then put them away. So then when you take them out again, it's still new and exciting, and it lends itself, you know, like we've had this conversation about if you stitch too many things, then your whole house is like a stitchery. And it, you know, what do you do with things? But on a Christmas tree, there's just endless opportunities to do things. Right. Like I did a quilted, tree skirt a bunch of years ago, and it was my default one, because what I really, really want to do still is I want to do a crazy quilt tree skirt.
Oh boy.
And so I've been collecting, because, you know, we don't collect any things, scraps of fabric over time. And it's just, you know, bits of, you know, beautiful, rich green velvet and, you know, plaids with metallics in them, and just things that would lend itself to that, because it just seems like that's what that needs to be.
Yep.
So that will happen someday.
Yeah.
I'm not sure when.
Well, that in the needlepoint world, that's one of my favorite times is Christmas, because I love watching all the people, all the women, who have entire trees covered with stitched ornaments.
Yeah.
And some will have a conventional tree, and then they'll have a second tree that's just their stitched ornaments, or they'll just cover the stair rail with them. I love seeing all those things years and years. And you talk about, things that you have a memory for this time in your life or that time in your life,
exactly.
You know, those ornaments, and some of the people out there that have just hundreds of these ornaments, you know, boxes of them, and bring them all out at Christmas, and what fun that must be to pull them out. Oh, this is the one I did the year our daughter was born, or this is the one, you know, I did for the new house or whatever. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think I've learned too that what I haven't done in the past and what I've learned to do now is to date things, you know, put a date on the back of them, because you'll sort of remember, but if you had the year, that's your key. And then you'll be able to really remember what it was. And it's nice too to have. You know, I remember when my mom passed away, looking through, that was one of the things that we did, was we kind of broke down the old Christmas tree ornaments, because there's six siblings, there's six of us, and just splitting up a lot of the things that she had made or that we had made as children, you know. So, and what a pleasure that was to just go back through the history of our family on a Christmas tree, you know.
Yep. Yeah.
It's really neat.
Yeah. So. Yeah, so anyway, there it is, Shepherd's Bush. If you're looking for a stocking, it'll look really great and not take you 30 years.
And I think it's beginner-friendly.
Yes, oh, definitely, yeah, yeah. And they're just neat. It's just neat design. So
Yeah.
But the thing that happened to me, though, is, you know, I've been doing a Debbie Rowley chart. I'd been doing charted needlepoint designs, Debbie Rowley and others, the Lady Edith one from Gay Ann Rogers, and those that you got to pay attention. And so I think, oh, cross stitch, a simple cross stitch chart, I can just do mindless stitching.
No,
you can't. You actually have to pay attention to where you're putting the needle, because just getting Cooper's name in, I thought I can quickly put this down, and I'd forgotten how you really have to make an effort to get the name centered and spaced and everything. I had to tear it out twice. And then the next row down is snowflakes. And again, I just got cocky. This is just cross stitch. I can just work my way through it. And actually, that's back stitch for the snowflakes. You know, what's back stitching? That doesn't take any effort. And yeah, next thing I know, I'm off by two threads, and it's like, okay, I got to pay attention. So much for mindless.
A little bit.
Yeah.
Definitely. So, yeah, I found the same. So I'm stitching the Debbie Rowley Diamond Delight 10. And so now we get to go through all Christine's beginner mistakes.
Yeah. So I'm curious. So you've got started, and you've posted a couple of pictures. Looks really nice. But I wanted to ask you, what are you experiencing? What's going through your mind as you work through this thing? And of course, Debbie's charts are, I mean, it's a roadmap to success. There's no question
it
about
is.
That. But yeah, tell about that. I'm curious. What's it been like for you just kind of getting this going?
Well, okay, let's see. What is it like? So to begin with, the canvas involves a piece of tool sort of stitched in kind of, I don't want to say randomly, but it's sort of, it fits into the design and it doesn't, and that's intentional. And so originally when I started it, I didn't have the tools, so I just left out the portion that was going to be the initial tacking down of the canvas. And then as I was doing it, I thought, you know what, rather than do that, I think I'm going to leave it out and just stitch it, because it's beautiful without it. It's not a required element at all. But what that had done was, because I left a row out, that was my north, right? Well, it's actually east on the canvas, but whatever. That was my landmark. And then once I decided not to do that, I stitched it in. And then I realized how easy it is when you have a canvas that's completely symmetrical, that to twist the canvas, and that it does matter what order you do the stitches, right? So if you have a stitch like a road stitch, and forgive me if this is the wrong thing, but I think it is, where every stitch, you know, the top stitch of the cross, I guess. So please just correct all of my terminology, because I'm not going to say the things the right way.
The top stitch, you always want to be going in the same direction. Yes.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. So right. Because I put the canvas down and then picked it up again.
Oops.
I turned the canvas. Exactly. So now the top stitch for part of them in this one, there's one square of these stitches, the top stitch is horizontal, and then some of them ended up being vertical. And as much as I like to embrace imperfect, every time I look at it now, because the thread it's stitched in is actually a little reflective. Yeah. It's not like if it was just like a pearl cotton or just like a DMC floss and it just kind of sat there, it would probably be okay. But because it's reflective, it really stands out that everything's reflective, and then this other section doesn't reflect light the same way. So I'm going to rip those out and redo them. So yes, what did I learn? I learned to mark the top of your canvas. So aside from that, I've learned that, I got a magnifying light, and it is remarkable because now I'm not struggling to, you know, take my glasses off, put my glasses on, take my glasses off. I can actually see the room and what I'm doing at the same time. And it is taking a little bit of getting used to stitching through a magnifier, not because it's in the way, but because I'm not used to actually seeing that well. So,
Okay. So there's a plus.
You know, I'm used to, and I mean, my corrected vision is fine, but it's not like when you're a little kid and, you know, you can look at things close up and you can see incredible detail. I think I've just gotten used to being able to not see that well. So, now I'm realizing that my vision really isn't so good. but anyway, the light made it a million times better, and it wasn't tremendously expensive. I can see, you know, several years from now, probably upgrading to something a little bit nicer, but it serves the function. And other than that, it's really just been a pleasure because each stitch is brand new for me. So I was doing waffle stitch last night, and so that was totally new. So, what's nice about the chart is, again, it's almost impossible to fail if you're paying attention, because everything is laid out well, and it literally is take your needle up at point one, put it in at point two, take it up at three, put it in at four. So as long as you count and, you know, like I said, pay some attention, and pay attention particularly to the tension of the thread, you can't not stitch it. Now, I'm not going to say you can't not stitch it well, because I'm sure there are things that I could do better, particularly with things like the ribbons or any kind of thread that is not like a cylinder, where you have to lay it. I'm definitely noticing things where I start stitching with something and then change something and notice how much better it is. So for an example, I was stitching with one of the, I think it was a Krynek ribbon, and it's stiff and it's got some metallic thread through it, and it's about an eighth of an inch wide. So first of all, it's just a beast to get through the canvas, but it's difficult because it wants to curl on itself.
Yes.
So you're fighting that the whole time. And then I remembered the lovely trick of flat ironing the thread. And what I had just anticipated that would just make it twist less, but it softened it up a little bit too. What I think that helped tremendously.
All right, so back up then, because I've never done the flat iron. So you just took your flat iron, must have it for your hair or whatever, and you just passed that thread through it quickly, slowly, medium? How did you?
I did all the ways because I didn't know what I was doing. So I figured I'd take some scrap thread and see, all right, at what point is it going to melt? So I know what it is.
She's a scientist. She has to know the melting point.
Exactly. I have to know where it's going to, I'm an engineer, so I have to know where it's going to fail. That's my point. Right.
Okay.
So, and it didn't melt at all.
Oh.
So, and that was surprising too, because I figured that at one point it would start to, because like acrylics and things like that will melt. I didn't have a problem at all. But so what do you do with the threads to flatten them out before you use them? Do you do anything to them? Do you pre-treat them before you start stitching?
Well, with the Krynek, I just fight with them.
Fight with them.
Yeah, because those are terrific little spools they come on, but when you pull the thread off, I mean, it's just a spiral.
It is.
You know, and so I just deal with it, and I use a laying tool to help me pull and lay the things down and I just work with it that way. I've never tried the iron. That's why I was curious what your experience was, because now I got to try that now.
It helped a lot. And I think you could probably just do it with an iron too. I think that would work maybe not as easily. It's not as convenient, but it could. So the thing that's driving me crazy with stitching with ribbon, and you can tell me whether I'm being too particular or not, is the hole that you're going into is smaller than the ribbon. So the ribbon is going to have to fold in some way. It doesn't fold in the stitch, right? So if you're crossing over 5 stitches, it'll lay flat. But as soon as you come up and as soon as you go down, it's going to have to fold. And it reminds me of like when you tie a tie, the tie also has to fold when it's in the knot and you want it to fold a particular way.
Yeah.
What I'm finding is that it drives me absolutely batty when it folds with the middle of the thread down and the edges up, because then it doesn't look as flat as when it folds so that the edges are underneath itself. Does that make sense? So
it makes perfect sense. And now I have to, I don't know that I've noticed.
Yeah.
I have to go back.
Makes me crazy. Oh. Because when I'm, when I'm stitching with it, it seems like it lays flatter and is smoother. So this is all in satin stitch. When I'm stitching in satin stitch, if it folds with the edges up like a taco, it doesn't look as smooth as if I can get it to fold with the edges underneath it.
Yeah,
like
I follow you. No, I follow you. Now I got it. I've never noticed, because I just make sure that the main stitch lays flat, but I never noticed, and then I try not to twist underneath to bring up the next one.
Yeah.
Try to keep it from twisting underneath, but I never noticed what was happening at the actual holes. Now I got to go back and look at a couple pieces. That's interesting.
It may be that it's twisting underneath and that's what's causing it to want to fold up like a taco. That's possible, because I'm not paying a whole lot of attention to the other side. So I will definitely start paying more attention to that. But that's what I'm noticing, is that the satin stitches, when they fold that way, seem to look a little smoother. But also I think it has a lot to do with its tension. It's getting the thread ironed so that the thread itself doesn't have any, or the ribbon doesn't have any twists in it, because sometimes it gets crinkled.
Yeah.
So any of those places that it's crinkled doesn't lay very nicely. But other than that, you know, just using the laying tool, I think makes a gigantic difference too. I can't see not using it. But I will admit that I get lazy and just use my finger sometimes.
Now with Krynek thread, I think I probably use a laying tool all the time with Krynek thread, just to make sure that it's coming all the way through the hole when you come up, and it's going through in the tension. Cause that wiry stuff, it doesn't want to behave. So,
it doesn't.
I end up using a laying tool all the time to tug, pull, push, whatever it takes to make it behave like it's supposed to. Yeah.
Uh huh.
Yeah.
Yeah. So that's what I'm finding with those. And we'll put up, I'll take a picture and send it. I don't know if I can take a picture close enough to show you what I mean about the taco fold.
No, I know you described it well. I know exactly what you mean. And now you really have me curious because those little things drive me nuts. So
Maybe this is something that, you know, anybody else would say, it doesn't matter. It looks fine. But it doesn't look, I look at that and say, that doesn't feel right. I wonder if there's a better way to do that or if I should be paying attention to how that folds when it's going through. I don't know. Anyway, that's what I'm learning so far.
Okay.
It's fun canvas to stitch, as I said before, because there's so many different stitches. So I'm learning a lot. And I want to say that there's some other hurdle that I'm encountering, but it's really just, it's a pleasure, honestly.
Well, hey, that's what it's supposed to be. I will say on the ribbon, I will ask this question now that I ponder it a bit, is whether you have a big enough needle that consider using a bigger needle to make a bigger hole in the canvas to pass that thread through.
That may be because I'm trying not to adulterate the canvas in any way.
Oh, no. Try a bigger needle. With Debbie Raleigh stuff, sometimes I'll have three or four needles working at once. Different sizes. Try a bigger needle so it forces the canvas threads open more and see if that doesn't make that ribbon behave better.
Yep, that would definitely help. And see, I thought the goal was to keep the canvas as true as possible. Like I've been intentionally trying not to stretch the whole.
No, depending on the thread you're using, and with a lot of these we're using different kinds, you find using different thread needle sizes to open the hole so you're not dragging that needle against the thread against the canvas.
That makes perfect sense. As long as I know. See, that's what I don't know what things I'm allowed to do.
On my needle minder, a lot of times I know the last Debbie Raleigh, I had four different sizes working at once.
That would help a lot.
So try that. You might find that makes the difference. I just was trying to think, how can this be a problem? And then I thought, intuitively, I just use a bigger needle. Try that. You want to open the canvas hole big enough to accommodate the thread so that it doesn't get dragged through there and get frayed. Cause as you get toward the ends of the length, then it'll start to get, lose some of its luster or whatever it is. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Cause it's starting to pop open. So here's a question though. Let's imagine an area of satin stitch and you have 20 in a row. If you're dilating the hole for each of them, by the time you get to the end, the cumulative addition in size for each of those holes, how does that end up working out, right? So if you add half a millimeter to the width of each hole as you're going across and you do 20 of them in a row, now you've got 2 millimeters off.
You wouldn't be doing that much, and the holes tend to collapse back down to a degree anyway. It's the needle opening up that hole so the thread will pass through at that moment that is really the important part. Yeah. They'll tend to collapse back down, and you've got it on a stretcher frame, so you know there's a limit. But no, you're not going to pick up that much. You're not going to get that much gain. That's going to be a factor. Yeah.
All right. I will try that.
No, try. Yeah, try that. Yeah. Yeah. No, I have. I think everybody has. I've got five little vials of different sizes of needles, and I just break them out. And the needle, the needle minder, both sides is got needles on it. So, because I tend to have needles on both sides. So if I finish off a thread on the back, and I'm not going to continue to use that needle, then oftentimes there'll be one on the back side too that I can pick it up. It's just.
See, this is the infrastructure thing. So it's my first canvas, so I don't have a lot of infrastructure. I need to build my needlepoint infrastructure.
Yeah. Yeah, just pick up.
Oh, I need a part-time job.
Yeah, there. Yeah, yeah. Part-time jobs support infrastructure quite nicely.
That's right.
Yep. Oh, I wanted to a couple of other things. I mentioned Gay Ann Rogers, the Lady Edith that I did. This is
beautiful. So I just have to say, now that I have started to stitch, looking at that canvas, I see it completely differently because I can appreciate what it goes into it to have it that even and to have all of the stitches laid so beautifully. So for anybody that hasn't looked at it, it's on our Facebook and Instagram. And A, it's a beautiful canvas. The colors are stunning, but it's just stitched so well. Right now, and now I really know what I'm looking at a little bit, and now I can really appreciate how well it was done.
Oh, well, thanks for that. But yeah, it's, and that's all silk and just a treat to work with. Pepper pot silk. Yeah. Really nice. Yep. So, that Lady Edith. Now, Gay Ann Rogers has a new chart that she just released here in May, and it's on sale in May. And of course, we all know Gay Ann has a sale for a month and then that's it. And her new design is Eleanor of Aquitaine. Now, it's a portrait of this Eleanor of Aquitaine, 1124, the most famous queen of the medieval period.
Yeah.
Now, generally, when I see portraits done in needlepoint, I think the faces just look dorky. It's so rare, but she nailed this thing. This thing is beautiful. I mean, I'd never stitch it because I don't care for this kind of thing. I just don't care. But this thing is just flat out beautiful. She nailed it from stem to stern on this design. That face looks natural. Mm-hmm. You know, there's an expression to it. The hair, the jewelry, the everything. This is just one beautiful piece. It really is. I just applaud her for her effort on this.
It is. And you know, I can't think of anything that lends itself better to different textures of stitchery than something that's medieval inspired, right? Because that's, you know, sort of the era of the heyday of tapestries and things like that. You know, the only other thing I could think that would be like that would be like a William Morris inspired piece.
Mm-hmm.
But this is okay. So don't worry, I'll stitch it.
Okay, go ahead. No, it's beautiful. It really is. And, you know, I've seen other portrait type things and everything around the face is beautiful, and then you look at the face, and for me, it just ruins it because it's just not well executed.
Right. That's hard to do.
The eyes are gorgeous. The mouth, mm-hmm. I mean, everything. She really is just, what talent to be able to do that. True talent. And everything just looks bejeweled and royal and regal.
Beautiful.
And yeah, it really is nice. So call attention to that. And then I wanted Mary Corbett. Did on May 1st, and she did a blog post of testing that she had been doing with different kinds of linen and the quality of linen. And it is really eye-opening. She had some that she bought from a supplier, and she has this method, it's on explained on her website somewhere, of when you get linen, how you wash it, and how you lay it out and iron it before you stitch so that you get the shrinkage out of the way. And particularly if you're going to use it for like a tablecloth or you know, something like that. She described about how she washed this linen that she got from this one supplier, and it just came all apart on the edge. The selvage just came all apart.
Ooh.
And just became this ratted mess. But her dryer, she puts them in the dryer. Her dryer filter was so packed with lint and fibers that she could almost couldn't pull it out of the dryer to clean it.
Wow.
But it's just an excellent post about that makes you stop to think about where you're buying your linen. And she says that one of the most important things to do is to ask where the linen was made. Apparently some people say this is Irish linen or Irish linen quality. And she points out that doesn't mean it was made in Ireland.
Yeah.
And so you want to know, if you can at all, you want to know exactly where it comes from. And she said Western European linens are much better than Eastern European linens. And sounded like Chinese linen, you might as well just go pull a rag out of the rag bag. For all their value, but it's just a good rundown. And of course the underlying thread to this thing, thread, no pun intended. The underlying, issue is if you're going to do something, stitch on ground cloth, linen ground cloth for something that you want to last forever, invest in good linen. if it's something that's going to be a hand towel that is going to get washed multiple times, then maybe you don't need to invest in the top quality linen. But she's going through that process, and it's just an excellent blog post of some length. It's not just a quick hit. I mean, she actually gives detail about what her experience so far has been testing these different linen sources and what works, what is really holding up and is working well. And then I forget the name of the linen she always uses as kind of her go-to linen. Alba Maximus or something like that, that she uses. And she's mentioned that many times before. But so it's just a good thing. It helps just an excellent rundown of what, if you're buying linen, and we tend to use linen for a lot of things, here's what to look for and ask that question. So that was just a good thing. Well, it's Mary Corbett, of course it's good, but it's just a really good rundown, and I thought helpful no matter whether it's embroidery, needlepoint, or whatever it is you're doing. That's a good one. So that was her May 1st one, if you're not a regular follower of her, to look it up. So. Oh, and then let me throw one more. Oh, holy smokes, we gotta quit. I just looked at the meter on here. An hour we've been going. We gotta quit. A lot of floss tube posts these days, videos. One that stands out for me, and I've really enjoyed, and I won't give my opinion on floss tube. There are some good ones. But one that I'm really enjoying, she's only done four so far, is Arlene Cohen. And Arlene listens to us, and she writes to me every now and then, with comments. But, she just started doing it, and she does a lot of different kinds of stitching and does beautiful work. You can just tell it's just gorgeous work. And, she does a nice job with it. And her last two, number three toward the end and number four, she's a bobbin lacer. And so she shows a little bit about how to do bobbin lacing, which I find to just be a fascinating technique. And with all those, she has like a dozen of these bobbins all there, and somehow she knows how to make them into lace. And in number three at the end, she shows this lace collar she's making. It's absolutely gorgeous. Beautiful. Yeah. So fun just to watch her work that a little bit. But enjoying Arlene Cohen, Cohen on YouTube, FlossTube. She's got four of them. So, that's worth checking out. So we got to stop.
Okay.
And all the way back to the beginning, don't forget Connie Rich.
Yeah.
She'll appreciate the support. That's it. We're done. We're out.
All right. Take care.